Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
There is one. I scored for the under-21s, and I genuinely don't remember it. Like, I've got, there's a picture in the middle of the book from when I scored in the semi-final for England. I have no idea what happened. The thing I remember the most from it, from that game, was the fact that we went to penalties and I was concerned I'd have to take one.
Yeah.
And the fate of the universe on my shoulders was not what you want when it's a penalty shootout.
Getting it back off Halper. Now Morrison. Carroll. Anua!
Welcome to the Book Club on Football Ramble Presents. I'm Kate Mason.
I'm Jim Campbell.
And today we're joined by one of the most thoughtful new voices in the game, a recently retired defender with an eye for a goal whose career bridged the old Manchester City and the new. A City fan who was brought up a few minutes away from where the Etihad would be built just over a decade later. The son of an engineer dad and a microbiologist mum with a doctorate, Nedim Anuha was always expected to excel academically, and his brilliance as a footballer was never going to stop him from taking education seriously, making him one of the very few male elite footballers who can boast straight A's at A level. Not that Nedim finds showing off natural.
This is wild. After the match, Zlatan goes into the RSL locker room, apparently to apologize to Nedim for his antics during the game. But as you can see, Nedim isn't having it.
All right, our final
he
score.
He sends Zlatan out.
This is a guy who's the face of the MLS, as he calls himself, but this is the way that he plays on the field. So I don't care if someone comes in and tries to say that to me. You don't say that on the field. I don't care. I'm not going to accept his apology. It's unacceptable.
The story he's been able to tell about the world of football in his book, Kicking Back, is intriguing and nuanced. In over 400 club games in England and the States, he's worked with everyone from Neil Warnock to Roberto Mancini. And best of all, he's happy to be honest about what that's really like.
Mate, more up than away. And it's buried by Nedim Anuha. Well, West Bromwich Albion protests begin, but Manchester City have doubled their lead on 20 minutes.
Nedim, thank you so much for joining us for Book Club.
I can't believe you've called me a defender with an eye for a goal. Like, that's one thing that sort of pained me throughout my career, the stress of not scoring enough every season.
Really? So,
yeah, massively, massively. It's like, it's really disappointing when you don't score, even though it's not part of, like, your game.
Yeah.
Like, I've had a ton of chances, and I've come so close, and it seems such a simple thing to do. Yet still, I've been kind of incapable of doing it for lots of years.
Was it 18 you got?
I think it was about that, yeah.
That's not a bad return for a defender, is it?
Well. Depends how many set pieces you go up for every season. Yeah. You know, it depends how often the ball drops to you. So I'll take it, because more than a lot of people I know, but it's still a long way behind some other people that I know as well.
Yeah. There's a really cute intro at the start of the book with Micah Richards and Joe Hart. And Micah says that you talk about it as well, that you were a striker when you were a kid.
Yes, that's right.
But he then absolutely slates your technique.
But is this Micah saying this or Joe?
Because I think it was Micah.
Micah's got no leg to stand on. Like, he is a literal disaster when it comes to scoring goals. So I'll take it from Joe, who basically lived in my head when we used to do shooting practice at City. But Micah cannot say a word. If anyone's got anything to say about that, just have a search of his penalty in a preseason game.
Right.
It's gone over the post in rugby, like, comfortably over. You're having to check a video replay to see if it actually went through. That's how high it went. So he cannot say a word to me about any of that.
Interesting decision, isn't it? I thought, Jim, to get these two guys to just have a free-for-all as the intro for your book.
Yeah.
How did you come up? Was that something you did with your co-writer?
Yeah, it was, yeah. So shout to Hugh Ferris for that. And those two know Hugh as well. And I think those two people know me well, so they can give like an honest depiction of who I am as a person, but in a slightly different way, because the book itself, you know, from a footballer's standpoint, it's not really a traditional one as such, and it does have its sort of quirks to it. So why not start with something like that with some familiar faces? And as I say, they know me for a very, very long time. They know my intent. They know my ups, they know my downs. But then they also would do anything in the world for me. So, you know, that's a real privileged position to be in. And I think they did a very good job, to be fair.
It really comes through, actually, the warmth there, which is why Micah feels comfortable slating your technique
in an intro
that's meant to praise you.
I know. You call me boring as well. You know what I mean? Like, what do you want to read in the first few pages of a book about yourself? To read how boring you are. So this is good then, yeah? This is going to just be an encyclopedia or something. Let's just read through that for fun. But I'd say 99% of the people I played with are quite fond of me. So I think come the end of the book, you'll sort of sense why that is. But those two are fantastic. And yeah, I was very happy to have them on board.
Yeah, there's a real sense of warmth, I think, when you're talking about a lot of the people you've played with and people who've been important to you in your career and, of course, your family as well. I mean, Kicking Back covers the story of your playing career, really, right up to the point where you retired. But it's also the story really of you finding your voice and in some cases reassessing things that have happened in your career. Is there one thing that stands out that you would have liked to have done differently?
There's probably more than one thing, to be honest. But when it comes down to what I would choose, it wouldn't necessarily be something that would maybe have advanced my career. Because, you know, if I would have, say, listened a bit more or paid more attention to certain things or understood what managers were like, I maybe would have lost the experiences that I've had. And I love them. Like, I love spending time in London. I love going to the USA. And those moments came from decisions that I made when I was younger. And I think, and I feel like I'm a good person now. So, you know, I can deal with that. But it's more so the things like within the book, the issue with the emails sent to my mom, which were basically making lighthearted jokes about her health situation. Because in hindsight, you know, I didn't know that her diagnosis was terminal.
Yeah.
So I wonder how I'd feel if I received something like that. And if I knew that was the case, like to this day, today, I would fight that battle for people, for other people, not just myself. So to then go back to that time and think in my mind that I had to be respectful because essentially I didn't have leverage at the club and things like that. And I was concerned, like that completely misses the point. And I think there are a few instances of that, whether it was even say when I didn't get go to play for Nigeria one time because I was concerned with my situation with City because I wanted to stay. I never had plans to leave. And I thought, well, if I go away, it will negatively affect my club situation. Like you got to think bigger than that. Because just this February, I was doing the AFCON coverage to Remain Genius, and we were looking at some of the news articles, which were sort of downplaying the importance of the Confederation Championship for a continent. Whilst at the same time, when the tournament's going on, you're seeing different versions of Salah and Mane, because this is their happiest versions, because they're representing their country. So then for me to think like that, then I just want to try and play for City. It just completely misses the point. And now I'm retired. I've not got any caps to my name. And, you know, I'm a bit sad about that to a certain extent, but maybe the outcome would have been the same, but the working would have been different, you know, in terms of explaining and trying to figure out what I needed to do. So they're just the name, but two things, but there's tons of stuff in there. And I think ultimately, you know, I am where I am today because of those decisions and the consequences that came off the back of it and sort of being able to take it and understand why it was good, bad or indifferent.
That's the real benefit of the book as well, I suppose, is, you know, it's much easier to sit back at this stage when you've achieved what you have and you've come to the end of your career and say, I could have handled that differently.
Yeah.
But of course, when you were playing for City, you know, you were so invested in that club.
100%, yeah.
So I don't know that you, even if you had slightly different information, just having read it, I don't know that you necessarily could have made that decision.
I think what would have helped, and this is going to sound so like egotistical or whatever, is someone like me today supporting me back then.
Yeah.
You know, like a senior pro or somebody who actually has your best interest at heart. But that time for City, just around the takeover, it was like a really weird time for a lot of people because nobody was really established enough with the new management and the new ownership to be able to sort of have the leverage to say, we're going to stick up for the collective.
Yeah.
Everyone was basically in a new situation. And even after that, when Mancini came in, like nobody, there was no one that was guaranteed to be playing. And that's a weird place to be at a football club because even though everyone's a player, you do have this sort of hierarchy whereby this is the main person, this is the next tier, and this is everybody else. So all of a sudden, when you've got a team made up of everybody else, it's kind of leaves you in a position where you root for yourself. And also within football, as you guys know, like it's just excessively macho. You can't, back then you can't see, you're not going to be seeking help from someone coming over and tapping your one of your teammates inside, oh, could you help me with this, please? I'm struggling. What do you think I should do? Like,
yeah,
you sort of fight your own battles, essentially.
There's a real sense of that coming through, actually, that there is a reluctance to speak and to actually just speak openly and honestly and for people to be able to sit down and go, okay, look, perhaps this could be done differently, or I don't understand why this is working. A really good example is you talk about the moment you talk about that you meet Roberto Mancini and he essentially asks you when you'd be fit. You not unreasonably joked that the physio could say that with more authority than you, and he reacted really badly to it. It seems like a real sliding doors moment.
Yeah.
And also reading the book thinking, you know, could you have had a conversation with him in the dressing room or had a, you know, had a sort of like heart to heart to explain that? But the impression comes through that's impossible in football because there are too many walls up everywhere, and even players in favour don't feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think over the years it's probably changed a little bit, but that was a, looking back, there's no guarantee that you would have liked me or played me, but in time you realised how much he hated people that were injured, like with a passion.
Heard this about Mourinho as well. It's a weird thing that like he barely speaks to injured players.
Yeah, with Mancini, honestly, with Roberto Mancini, for as good as he was as a coach in terms of setting up a side to play in a certain way, and I promise you he was good because to this day, like I play five a sides on a Wednesday and I'm still doing things in a five-a-side, which he taught me 12 years ago. Like, he's corrupted my brain. But, like, you've not got qualification in medicine. You've not been working as a physio for 20 years. So when you walk into the treatment room, that's not your domain. Mm. Yet still, he sort of carried himself as if it was. And he applied a lot of pressure to the physios, to the players. Because now everyone, again, like I said, nobody was on like a stable footing at this point. I think City, a couple of years after, they changed it so that the staff were like contracted to the City football group as opposed to the playing side.
Right.
But at that time, that wasn't the case. So the pressure's on for those people because it was just in a traditional environment whereby if a manager doesn't like you, they can sack anybody they want within the organization. So when a guy comes in and, you know, the physio sees you and says, you know, this is a 4-week injury, the manager comes in and says, no, it's a 2. Before you know it, how do you reckon those 2 weeks going to go where he's expecting you back? He's going to hold it against you and against the medical staff. But that's just based on somebody who doesn't really know much about injuries. So, yeah, that's a sliding doors moment. And just the way football is, to be fair, it's probably the same as most workplaces, though. You know what I mean?
Like, I am actually thinking that.
Everything appears the same. Yeah. Everything appears the same. Like, everyone's the same. And, you know, you just go and speak. Come knock on my door whenever. We can knock on the door. It doesn't mean someone's going to answer. That's the irony.
My door's always open. I'm somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that is a really interesting point in the specific context of football because, of course, one of the things I mentioned in the intro is that you are more better educated, as in you followed the path of education quite a lot further than most of your peers and probably most of the people working, certainly in men's football. It's slightly different in women's football because, of course, there's not so much money in it, so people have to think about what they might get up to if they had to have another career afterwards. But it seems almost like at certain points in the book that your intelligence, which could have been helpful in many contexts, was almost seen as a negative sometimes. Because you're asking these questions.
Yeah, I think sometimes. But then also, that sort of thing makes you different in the group. Mm. And different in a group is not always a strength. Like when I was at QPR, there was a player who'd been to university, come up through the leagues, and we signed him. And he never really fit in because a lot of people within the group said he was too normal.
Too normal.
That's a hard
criticism to take, isn't it?
And how do you react to that? Like, what do you do? But he came in, he might wear the same shoes for 3 days in a row. He might wear the same jeans for 2 days in a row. And then the jeans and stuff were coming from like Topshop and all this stuff. So he looked like a 22, 23-year-old male does after they finished university.
Yeah, because that's what he was, right?
Exactly that. But he was also playing in the Championship in a place where people were spending most of their money on like Balenciaga shoes and all this stuff. So he was too normal. And it broke my brain, that one, because I was watching it happen. I was like, is this where we're at? Like, somebody's too normal to fit in this group. And the only way he's going to fit in is if he starts acting up to the stereotype.
Yeah, it sounds like school, but it never ends.
Yeah, literally, it just carries on forever. And I think that's the way that football is. I think at times it's a brilliant game. Being involved in a team and being successful, getting the chance to play with people who end up being your friends and being paid to play football is incredible. But then there's certain things that go on, we'll call it football politics and the like, which just don't make sense because it's essentially like a group of people all following along with something, but nobody's leading it. So when something sorts of goes wrong, like, how do you address it when there's nothing at the forefront of it, if you know what I mean?
This is one of the really interesting things about the book. We were talking earlier on, a lot of footballers' books. So this happened and then this happened and this happened. But you're at pains to sort of give a proper explanation of what it's like mentally to be a footballer and the emotional journey that you go on through these kind of experiences. Was that a deliberate choice?
Yeah, So I've been doing certain bits of media for the last 18 months now, and I was making sure, because I did a little bit before I retired, but I was making sure that what I say represents what football actually is, as opposed to the way that, you know, it can be depicted from the outside, because you've got maybe 4 or 5 gatekeepers who will tell everybody that it's the same up and down the country according to their experiences. Like, prime example, I've had managers who give you tactics for a game on a Saturday, which you know aren't going to work, but you work hard at them from Monday through Friday and then try and do it on a Saturday. Mm. Lo and behold, it doesn't work. But you've been a good teammate and a good player because you've tried to do what the manager told you to do, which is the whole hierarchy within a football club. But then come Saturday night, you're being blasted as players for being not good enough. Mm. And like, people forget the reason people are doing what they're doing on Saturday is because they've been told to do it. But then if somebody then decides to go off and do their own thing, they're perceived as a hero sometimes. But that's actually somebody being a bad teammate. So the honesty, like, football, it is a great sport. But say, before I went to Queen's Park Rangers, I used to sort of drink the Kool-Aid that was always available on TV and see lots of people get angry every time they saw somebody celebrate when they finished 17th. I was like, look at this, pathetic. You know what I mean? Got no ambition, no drive, no this. The next thing, transfer me to a team that's down there, is losing every week. And it's not about finishing 17th, because you don't get a badge that says you finished 17th. You get a Premier League badge on your shoulder for the next season. You've guaranteed that you'll play at the highest level once again with the opportunity to be better next season, with the opportunity for everybody to keep their jobs, to keep their salaries.
Yes.
Like, it's far bigger than the 17th. But the person, lo and behold, the person saying it has probably never finished outside of the top three or top four.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's a level of honesty which needs to be expressed. Not everybody will care, because they do obsess about success, but success is relative.
I think that's a really good point. And I think your assessment of football and the way it pieces together and your experience of it. And for example, being honest about how you didn't want to drop down from the Premier League, but then, you know, you were signed by QPR and as it goes, that's what it turned. And you, of course, were captain for the club. I mean, how did you feel? Because you've talked already about people, this normal guy being semi-ostracized in the dressing room. How did you feel about the influence you were able to have there?
At Queen's Park Rangers, it was far greater in the last 3 years when I was captain, because the squad was changing and I was becoming one of the, not just senior players, because I've been there for 3 years. I was there for 6.5 years. So I wasn't senior because I'd been there for the time. I was senior as well because I was a bit older and I spent a lot of years playing in the Premier League and the like. I think at that point, this must have been 2015. The start of the 2015 season, I'd been playing for 11 years and the squad was changing. They were recruiting younger players and they were starting to recruit players from lower down in the football pyramid as well. So my experiences meant a lot and people listen to what I was saying, should I have anything to say. But there was a big thing, because it felt really proud to be selected by Chris Ramsey, the manager at the time, to lead this next generation, because I'd always been somebody, with what I'd been through, I understood the importance of like being heard and being understood and being asked about. So then when I did take that on board, like, I was a significant part in terms of setting the culture at the club for those 3 years, and I loved it, because it meant that some of the poisonous things which were there before, I wasn't really going to stand for now, because I had a bigger voice, had a louder voice, and people trusted me. And it wasn't just like the management that trusted me, it was the players as well. And I was really happy, because I remember at times thinking, like, I wish I had this when I was younger. Like, I've had some captains, for example, who say that the team want this or the team want that, but that's what they want. But you'd be none the wiser, because they do things behind people's backs. You know, they're performative captains. They do it for the armband and for the picture and to say that that's who they are. But for me, it was never about me. It was about everybody else. Because I thought, if we have true harmony within the group, then whatever success turns out to be, we can still enjoy being on the journey together. You know, because at the end of the day, as I said before, not every team can finish top of the league, like finish near the top or be near the top. We can still have a successful season based on what you have. So me, as I say, being captain, and then those final 2.5 years in the USA as well, I was able to make the most of my experiences, make the most of my voice, make the most of understanding how a football club works. Because there are lots of people within football who somehow think like their boots just arrive in their locker every day as by the little boot elves or something like that. You know, but I know it's the kit man. I know the kit man's been in from this time, has been doing this, has been doing that. Like, also, you've somehow miraculously have tickets, or you miraculously have this or you have that. Like, football is such an amazing sport. You walk through the door and like, poof, everything's done, everything's there. But I understood it, so I brought everybody on board. And as a consequence, like, when you came in, it was less work and more like a place that you wanted to be, which I think not everyone gets the pleasure of doing.
Is part of that generation, or do you think, you talk in the book about yourself and Stephen Ireland being on £80 a week when you were
big money back then, you know.
Yeah, right. But that's the sort of money you associate with like kind of 70s or 80s footballers. Yeah. I was absolutely astonished to learn. I remember it being in the press a few years ago as well, that's what the City youth players were on at that time.
So the £80 a week, it's to put it into context, it's not a lot of money, but it's an incredible amount of money when previously you were making nothing.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, you think you've got all the freedom in the world with that £80, you know, because you're not paying bills. So instead it's like, yeah, I'll go to, in fact, Nando's, I don't think was even around at that sort of time. But it's like, yeah, I'm going to go to Pizza Hut. Mm. I'm going to go to Boots, get this meal deal. Mm, look at me, king of it all.
You like, would have had the all-you-can-eat ice cream, I imagine. There's a common theme in the book about eating a hell of a lot all the time.
I eat a lot of food. I'm a grazer as well. I'm not really a meals guy.
Right.
So I'm more dangerous.
Every day is tapas.
Yeah. I'm very dangerous between meals. Yeah, I can get after it. But yeah, the £80 a week and stuff, it sort of humbles you because you're doing it. You're playing the sport, but it's not for the money because the money's not changing your life. But it does allow you freedom to be able to do certain things. Like I remember on a Friday would be the day we'd go and get expenses. And myself and the twins, Nathan and Jonathan Delaye, who I came through the academy with, we used to get bus passes. So when they'd like give us the money back for a bus pass as an expense, he felt like I was the richest man. He has a little £10 extra. Also forgetting that I need that money to go and pay for the next bus pass for the next week. But culturally, it was brilliant. And obviously money is very much involved in football now. And to be fair, I've got a question for you guys, if that's all right.
Please.
So relatively speaking now, when within football do you think you've made it? Because the old guard would say when you've played like 3-4 seasons, 100 games or something like that, yeah. But in this day and age, you can make a lot of money and never play for a first team.
Yeah.
And when you think about it as a in my opinion, like, I'm sorry, I might be leading you down an answer here.
Yeah.
But you're a professional instead of an amateur. And for lots of people who play the game, they come from nothing.
Yeah.
So realistically, when have you made it?
As from a fan's perspective?
Both possibly, yeah. Fans or from within.
For me, because football seems so removed from what my life is like, essentially the moment a player gets onto a Premier League pitch, I think, well, he's going to have a career, even if necessarily not in the Premier League. This is going to be his career for a significant portion of his life. So it feels pretty instant to me, but I imagine there are a lot of players that do just drop off that you forget about them and you never hear of them, right?
So from a fan's point of view then, if a player gets to 21 and they never play for the first team and they quit, but financially they're secure for the next 20 years of their life
Bloody
and they've moved
hell.
Their family out of a situation, have they made it or have they failed?
Why did they quit?
They've succeeded. I mean, they've succeeded in an aspect of life, but I don't think... Can you really say they've succeeded as a footballer?
This thing about football, I think, especially in the UK, not necessarily as much in the USA because it's more of a middle-class sport overall, is like the people who play it, the vast majority have nothing and come from nothing.
Mm.
So when football changes your life, does it matter that you've not got the games written down on Wikipedia to say that, you know, this is how your life changed?
No, absolutely not.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of those kids and stuff will get like real abuse from it. People say, oh, you never made it, you're just doing this, you're doing that. But the reality of the situation is most people do not make it have a career.
Of course,
most people do not do it.
Well, that feeds into the whole question that we often talk about as well, which is people getting very upset about footballers not, you know, being obsessed with the game.
Right.
You know, the common example is the situation with Gareth Bale at Real Madrid, for example.
Ben White's had it recently as well because he dared to mention he doesn't always watch Match of the Day.
Oh, shambles.
Yeah.
How dare he?
Outrageous, isn't it?
To be fair, I stopped watching Match of the Day about 11 years ago. And then I had to eat my words as I was then sitting on the Match of the Day stage about to come on and the music started playing. I was like, oh my God.
It is exciting.
Yeah, it was really good. I've made it. I've literally made it. I'm on Match of the Day.
So that's the answer.
Yeah. Once you become a pundit on Match of the Day, then you've made it. Come through unscathed.
That's it, yeah. That's the bar, yeah, for sure.
That must be weird sitting on that set because we've all seen the pictures of Match of the Day without the graphics on it, right?
Yeah.
Must feel odd.
Yeah, it's very, very odd. And so obviously the show depends on the people that are on it, you know, because they do have opinions and stuff and everybody's got opinions. But certain opinions, I think, are more entertaining or more like thoughtful than others. It still makes for a good show regardless, you know, depending on whoever's tuned in. But this was for a Match of the Day too, and we had to get in for 2 o'clock and the show was going live at 11. So you're watching the games you watched the first two games and you spent about 4 hours just doing analysis and preparing stuff.
That is quite tough. So that was your first...
That was my very first gig and I thought, oh my God.
That was your first gig?
That was my first Match of the Day gig.
Not your first telly gig.
No.
Jesus Christ, that would have been insane.
I'm regular to this. But that was my first Match of the Day gig. And I knew that, you know, they watch games, but I didn't think it was going to be that long because the last game finished at like 6 and we weren't on for 5 hours.
Energy-wise, that's hard as well.
Yeah, so then I'm sitting down on the stage and it's like everyone says, oh, good luck. And I look next to me, there's like Mark Chapman and next to him is Ian Wright. I'm like, how did I end up here? It's like I've been teleported or something. But then the music plays. I'm like, oh my God, like this is real. Because I've been on Football Focus a few times.
Yeah.
Like, this is real. This is real. And then Chappers says, oh, it's Chappers, yeah, if you heard me. I said, Chappers. God, unbelievable.
I still call him Mark. I don't feel like I've got to that level yet.
And then next thing he says, oh, yeah, so welcome to Match of the Day 2. And now here we go straight into the first game, Spurs. And I'm sitting there for 8 minutes thinking, I'm watching these highlights again. It's like, oh, I forgot this is what the show's like. We don't really bash through this, do we? And yeah, for an hour, we then talk about the game after talking about the game for the last 6 hours. But, yeah.
Did you find it natural? Were you all right? Just kind of...
As you've probably gathered, like I don't mind talking, like, so it's all good. And I really enjoy football, but I enjoy football for what it is. So there's stuff that I can add in the same way other people can add, which maybe people don't think about all the time. So
yeah.
I think as a pundit, and I actually hate the word pundit. I want to drift towards being called a broadcaster.
I hate the word podcast. Some of this stuff just sticks in your head, doesn't it?
Yeah, like I don't. When I think pundit,
I hate the word podcast. Because it relates to iPods, right? They're
old.
Throughout my life, I have had to explain to people what word podcast means
much. Right.
Yeah, you've caught me with that actually. But yeah, I don't like the word pundit because when you think about like a football pundit, I picture a certain type of person.
Yeah,
but the stuff I'm saying doesn't feel like it belongs in that sort of realm. But that's still exactly.
And I mean, you know, it's like, I think because what you're talking about, back to knowing about what the kit men do, back to having a sense of how things fit into the ecosystem. I think sometimes, especially modern football, like even after when you've been playing, is so organized, as you say, for people to not really know anything about the world around them.
You can sort of go through a day and have everything done for you, but not know how it's done. But then that's not really taking part in what a football club is. Because the more people you know, the sort of better your experience, I feel, because there are lots of good people behind the scenes.
People might argue that you just focus on your football and...
But there's some people argue about anything, let's be clear about that. And in regards to that, it's the same thing where when I was doing my A-levels, they said, oh, have you found time to do that and then still play football at the same time? Well, I'd finished training at 1, and I got to bed at like 10, 11, so seems like there's a bit of time to maybe do something else, perhaps.
Yeah, great.
But I don't know, maybe I'm just being cynical.
Does that sort of stuff bleed into dressing rooms then? Because we all see, you know, fans with mad opinions about exactly that sort of thing. Like, oh, just get your head down, just focus on your football. Like, you see, you know, if a club tweets that they've got a new shirt out, that all of the comments will be like, oh, stop focusing on fashion, think about football, as if those things are linked up. Does that stuff affect dressing rooms?
Jim's an Arsenal fan, can you tell everybody?
Yeah, he's clearly rattled by something, yeah. I've gathered this year, yeah. You can, as a player, if there's something big going on, you'll know about it because you'll be asked about it by journalists and alike. So you can't just escape things.
Mm.
And so if you know you're going to be asked about it, you've got to look into it to know what answer you want to give. Because that's the whole beauty of football. Say as many words as possible while saying nothing.
Yeah.
You know, that'll keep you safe. So it does bleed into things. But I think within football, there are some people who like play football who get it. And other people who play football who are essentially just the same as like a fan who has no real understanding of how it all works anyway. Because some of the takes and stuff that I've heard across the years about people and their experiences within football, I'm like, what are we talking about here? You know what I mean? Like, it's never been a thing. Like, there was a guy... this was last year, I think, or a year and a half ago, while fans weren't still in stadiums. And it was when Van der Beek was playing in the game for Man United. And he said that within the game, you can see the United players, they're seeing Van der Beek, but they're not playing him the ball because they don't really trust him yet.
Mm.
And he said, but whereas when Bruno Fernandes is on the field, you know, people are taking extra touches to try and find where he is to give him the ball at all times. And I thought back through 16 years as a pro, like the prior 10 years or whatever in the academy, and at no point have I taken extra touches whilst desperately searching for somebody on the field because they're the only person that can save the day. Like, if somebody's in the right spot, it doesn't matter who it is, it's the right spot to play the ball. But they said that, and said that in, like, on a microphone, and people heard it, and then it sort of just perpetuated this belief that Van der Beek was struggling at United. And you just think, come on, like, that's never been a thing. And there's no way you played the game that way. Or is there? Yet still, that's then the perception that fans will have because this person that played football said it.
These things are massive in football, aren't they? You talk in the book about how it's really common among new managers to say that the squad isn't fit enough.
Yes.
It's like these things get parroted and parroted. It's like people don't seem to have their own thoughts. It's just like there is an accepted thought for this situation. So I, a proper football man, will use that thought because I understand football.
Yeah. And
that
sounds an extension is the whole thing of the danger of saying anything, of people using lots of words to say not a lot of stuff. Yeah. Because, as you know, because footballers are so famous, every time they say anything, it can be used as a headline or anything mildly interesting. Mm. Well, we were so grateful talking about the preview for the Champions League final that Salah had actually said, yes, it's a revenge mission rather than when asked who he'd prefer to face in the final rather than being like, well, they're two great teams and I'll do my best, whatever happens.
It is frustrating, but the danger of it is, like, as a player, you trust certain people more than others. But the people you trust more than others are the ones where you know what you say will hit print or be out there and put into the context you wanted it to be.
Yeah.
Whereas for other people, they're so thirsty for something controversial that you could say something that's mild and they'll turn it into something else.
I'm with you.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So you always end up being very reluctant. As a consequence, you literally say nothing. Like, you've got a press officer over your shoulder looking at you. And somebody asks you a question which might be leading, you go say, well, you know, it's we're going to try really hard. You know, we were unlucky last week, but this week we've got the motivation and we'll try our best and hopefully that'll be enough. You might have heard that once or twice before.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously,
man. Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
You talk a lot about various managers that you've worked under in the book, and it's great from the perspective, from the fan perspective, because it's interesting to hear. In some cases, some of the anecdotes really back up exactly what you imagine it might be like to play under, let's say, Harry Redknapp. How did you feel about doing that? And
Well, so I've had to think about this a lot recently on this sort of mini press run that I'm on.
Yeah.
And having to say it to different audiences, Because like when you get the questions asked, you literally have to think about this as a concept. And for me, there are people in the book who will be unhappy about things that have been said in the book. And there'll be people who will read the book or get like an excerpt from it who will say, well, why didn't you say this back then? And what I'd say to those people is that when you're part of an organization and you have a goal of being successful, you don't want to rock the boat at any point. Mm. So what you see on a day-to-day basis, just because it's not good, doesn't mean that you have to declare it's not good all the time, because all that does is create a crisis. And I was never somebody who'd create a crisis. Like I said earlier, I've had managers who give you tactics which you know won't work, but come Saturday, I'll still go and do them. And then I'll be criticized afterwards. But the fact is, I'm doing what I'm being told to do because this is my place within the organization.
But the specific example of Redknapp was one where you, there's a particular example in the book, right, where he sets up the team in order basically to prove a point.
Yeah. Is Harry, so Harry Redknapp, like by the time he was leaving QPR, he made a lot more sense. But when he first came in, it was bizarre because everyone was saying how good he was. But he just wasn't showing any of that when he first came in. I don't know if it was that realization of how bad we were as a team at the moment, at that particular moment, and the setup and infrastructure that we had. But there was no spark. He didn't bring a spark. And training, like, it was miserable. Those were some of the toughest stretches. When you're losing games week in, week out, and you've not got somebody to, like, bounce off, there's not really a ton of enthusiasm, because he relies a lot on his, like, coaches and stuff. And they were fine, you know, Kevin Bond, Joe Jordan and the like. But Harry wasn't this guy that I thought he was going to be. As I say, by the end, once he settled in, I got it. But for some of that, I didn't. And it's weird then, because we talk about saying nothing in the press. If somebody believes somebody's good, then whenever somebody gets a question, like I'm doing a press interview and someone says, oh, so it must be great to have Harry Redknapp here, you know. He's done so well across the years. It must be fantastic to have such a big coup to have somebody like him here. Well, I'm going to say yes or I'm going to say no.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I said no.
I literally cannot say no. Like, the answer's in the question, but it's not the right answer, but it's the answer. So you just carry on along with this sort of things and you're hoping for more. And like I say, in time, he got it. But as I was saying earlier, like with these managers and with some of the players and people that I mentioned, that's a realistic depiction of those times. And I don't know if they're the same times now. And I'm not trying to convince people to think otherwise, but I'll tell you about what happened and how it affected myself and the group. And within that group, there are tons of people who won't be writing in saying that it's a lie or it's not true, but they'll be very, very happy that something's been said because it's a more realistic depiction of the time as opposed to the fantastical view that, say, sometimes people are from the outside.
It sounds like that time in particular was pretty mad. There's a story about some warm weather training in Dubai where a couple of players overdid it the night before and were still drunk in training the next day.
Yeah.
Now that's...
So Harry Redknapp is big on people not drinking. Like, he's very, very big on it. I don't know the history behind it, but he's very big on it. So that's no problem for me. Like, it's fine. I'm in Dubai to train and I don't drink anyway. So it's stress-free. I'm just doing whatever I do, trying to just be as respectful as possible. What time's curfew? Bang. No issues, whatever. In typical me fashion. So then that day, there were so many people who'd gone out the night before, and to be fair, the night before that as well, that this training session was arguably one of the worst I've ever seen, like in the history of football, pro, amateur level, everything. But again, I was more embarrassed by it, but what can I do about it? That's the tone that they'd set. I'm not going to tell another grown man like they can't go out the night before if they choose to do that. Like, that's one thing that Harry
What can you do anyway?
That's the thing that Harry got wrong, like, telling people with children and freedom and stuff that they're not allowed to leave the hotel room past 10 o'clock whilst they're in Dubai, yet still a month later the players might be in Dubai on holidays, leaving the place past 10 o'clock. You know, very right. So it was a bad training session and he was frustrated. But then, like, don't take out on me. Like, I was actively trying to be a good professional. So then you take out on me, what's the point? If you've got an issue, take out with the people who are seeing, like, four footballs around their head. You know what I mean? Like, literally don't know which one to kick. And I'm here just trying to do the drills that I'm being told to do. Like, what are we doing here?
We need to get back to Manchester City. The day, perhaps we should talk about the Aguero day. Because, of course, you, by that point, four months earlier, you'd left the club and you were also on the pitch because you were playing for QPR and you were staying up, as it turned out.
Yeah.
What a ridiculous moment.
Ah, stupid moment, to be honest. It was. So I am a Manchester City supporter. Really into their latest title win, really into it, very much enjoyed it, all that type of stuff.
Okay.
So Liverpool fans, is that what's going on?
No, I'm Tottenham. But
relative success.
what a burn. It's true, though. It's true. That's the thing. Did you not win the Champions League? Oh, yeah, I'm actually very happy. I'm particularly context of sickness. Relative sadness. Yeah. but the
way you were, that Manchester City vibe is one that I think other fans probably struggle with a bit.
Yeah, honestly, I'm a Man City supporter, but every time I talk about football, try and be fair, if they lose, I won't say that City were bad or whatever. I'll talk about what the opposition did as well, because I'm actually watching a game of football. Like, that's my whole thing. I watch football. Lots of people don't do that. You know, like, if United lose a game, it's the Inquisition afterwards, isn't it? You know what I mean? Doesn't matter what Brighton did to beat them 4-0. It's like, oh, what did United do wrong today? I'm not that guy. Like, I'm happy they won it because I've been in the academy. I was at the academy when I was 10. Like, I felt it. So I'm happy that's the case. But in going back to that game, so I hate, at the time, I'll give you some very significant truths here. I hated Roberto Mancini, like, with a passion at that point, because he affected my life and the lives of lots of other people in a negative way. So I didn't have my full connection to the club at that point, because he was at the forefront of it. And something I found when I was a player there as well was at times he was terrible to all the players, but then he was brilliant in the media with his scarf, his flicking of the hair, his charm, his charisma. Delivered none of that to the training ground or to the dressing room. Oh, I don't like that. You know what I mean? Like, but again, you're trapped because the media love him. You gotta be yourself. Yeah. Yeah, but you should at least be consistent.
But maybe, whenever you go out in the media, it's a chance to sort of create your brand. Whenever you're with your team, with the team, then it's just about just putting your authority out there, essentially. So I didn't like him. All the players in the team were really liked, but I was frustrated because I'd basically been told to leave and I was treated like a villain for the first 6 months of the season there. So going to play in that game, having everything on the line for QPR, because I was desperate to stay in the Premier League. I didn't leave to go and play in the Championship. I had rent on a house in Richmond, and I managed to get a six-month thing, because if they went down, there was a chance that I might be leaving again. And I wanted to extend it because I really enjoyed living in Richmond. So there's a lot going on here. I want to stay, want to play, want to settle down and not have this thing whereby, do I stay, do I go? So going into the game, I'm obsessed. We've got to stay up. We've got to stay up. And their league title situation, like, it would have been great if they won it, but it's not going to be at my expense. And I wasn't going to play the game like that at all. So I went into the game.
Because people say you took the throw-in quickly.
I didn't take it quickly. That's just like, I'm going to come out of my shell here just for a moment.
Please.
Okay. Some of the things I've heard over the last few weeks are some of the most stupid things I've ever heard in the history of the world. Okay. Like, someone saying that, you know, the game needs to be investigated. Stupid. Yeah. How about you watch the game back and watch how it ended and ask yourself, if 7 or 8 bodies are on the floor with their hands on their heads, nearly brought to tears as a goal goes in, are they tears of happiness or are they tears of sadness? Exactly. So yeah, it was a weird feeling because I took the throw in. And I remember Jay Boffroy was down the line. I thought, you know, go there, everything's great. Time will expire. Next thing, like within football, you know when something's your fault. And I thought, well, I've lost the ball here. So if they score, this is going to be my fault. And I'm going to relegate my team in front of my old fans, old teammates, and that manager who I detested on the sideline. So I was in hell.
It's worse than an anxiety dream. Isn't
it? I could not have created a worse situation.
Naked, and that would have been the only way.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, or scored an own goal in the last second and taken us down. That's the only way it gets worse. But this, I thought, this is my fault. So I'm at the lowest of the lows, then the highest of the highs as the sea was staying up. But then only recently, whilst doing an interview about that game, somebody said, "Oh, when did the club knew that they were staying up?" And I said it was after the third goal went in. They showed me a video, and as I had the ball in my hands to take the throw in, 5 yards behind me, the bench are going wild, and I was none the wiser.
Wow.
None the wiser. And I said to a few of my friends when talking about it, well, you talk about sliding doors. If I knew that we were up at that point, I would have taken a throw in, but I would have been high-fiving people on the bench, shouting the message onto the field, and then the time just disappears.
Yeah.
But I definitely would have done it the exact same way that I did, which then led to them scoring a goal.
Whoa.
Conspiracy.
That needs to be looked at.
Yeah. Just look at it. The game is readily available. If anyone wants to watch it, you can see exactly it panned out the way that it did.
So you feel okay about being, in terms of being a City fan, which you are to this day? You would say.
Yeah.
Fully in. You don't.
There's a difference. For me, there's a difference between a fan and a supporter.
Okay.
I think a fanatic is like bonkers, can only see something blue.
For sure.
Like a fanatic. I didn't say fan, I said fanatic.
Got it.
But okay. I'm a supporter because I want them to do well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I root for the people I know who are still working there. And if things don't go well, I can be rational and try and figure out why that is and not say it's a conspiracy against the club.
Yeah, I wish everybody was that.
Yeah, it's not cool, yeah.
But of course, you, at the very start of our conversation, you mentioned the situation with your mum, the terrible situation where someone, more than one person at the club was effectively mocking a woman who was dying of cancer, who is your mother.
Yeah.
How does that not impact on how you view the club even today?
It does impact it, but it's like, it's an appreciation of the fact that a club is made up of many people. Mm. And what one person does not define what other people do, if you know what I mean, or how you perceive other people. And some of the people who are involved in that, to name them Gary Cook and Brian Marwood, like, I don't like Gary Cook. You know what I mean? I've got no interest in seeing Gary Cook again for the rest of my life. Mm. Brian Marwood, I have seen him, but as I say in the book, I'm frustrated because the way that I reacted then means that today I have to see him and treat him in a different manner because I didn't go all in back then. So I can't go all in now because it just feels, it's not the way like we deal with situations as adults, but I don't respect the decision he made back then and I'll never forget it. So every time I see him, it's not a case of like, he could say sorry to me, but I'll never move on from it. Because I know how bad that truly is to talk to somebody like that. I never in a million years would I do anything to that extent at all. Like, it's awful. So those are two people within the organization. But then in the same breath, I know people who've been there for longer than those two. Like a guy I called Danny Wilson, who I think is a managing director now. He was there at Main Road. And now he's a managing director of Man City. I know Claire Marsden, who's been in charge. He's basically been the club secretary for like 20 plus years. And when I see those people, it takes me back to when I was there and some really happy memories sharing time with them. So, like, Man City aren't just Brian Marwood and Gary Cook. It's an amalgamation of lots of different people. It's a feeling even amongst fans, you know, people who've played for the club, because a lot of players who play for the club keep coming back. Mm. They come back to work in different roles. So, you know, it's more than that. It's that's just the case with, like, fans all around the country. Like, you support your club, and when you do, and you're a big part of it, it's a feeling. You know, you can't explain it, but it's something which you feel a part of.
It's not a choice, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a compulsion almost. Mm. And I thought I was quite calm. You know, I thought I'm fair as a pundit, I'm fair because it's not just all about City for me. I end up being asked a lot of questions about City, but I'm fair. But when I was watching the game on the Sunday, I was all in. I was all in and I realised, yeah, I am fair, but I definitely want a particular outcome. Let's just say that.
Yeah, fair enough. And you work with City as well now.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I'm a trustee for the charity, which helped me when in the early 90s, because I went to a couple of soccer schools and I do some stuff for like some of the like documentaries and their match day life things. But again, like, that's not my core, because I like being out in the open forum discussing everything about football as opposed to just having to solely just dive into one particular colour.
So that maybe answers my next question, which is, because of your analytical brain and the way that you analyse certain mistakes or ways of managing that you've encountered over the course of your career, it seems like you've got a pretty good grasp of what you think works and doesn't work.
Yeah, but I'm also like, if I don't know something, I'll just say I don't know, but I look into it. Like, I love research and find out more about things. I love the idea of gaining different perspectives and sort of accepting the fact that, like, I don't have the final answer on anything. I can give you my opinion on it and I can, like, the beauty of some of the stuff that I do, like this, sorry to say it, podcast and stuff, but it's a chance to have an opinion and be able to explain it.
Yeah.
So then people can disagree, which is fine, but they'll understand where you're coming from, you know, and they're forced, they can wonder to themselves, would they think the same way that you do based on how you see things? So with the sort of analytical side of things, like, I understand there's more to it. It's very quick, especially within football and the tribalism, to think it's one thing. Bang, this is it. Oh, stupid, that's that. But I say, is it? You know, and there's sometimes, some of my friends will tell you about this, like, I will play devil's advocate over something I don't even believe in myself, and it really frustrates them. But it's just showing that there's more to any particular situation. You know, it's never as simple as we make out, and I've learned that the hard way across the years.
Yeah, is it Joe Hart who's like, you'll never win a fight again?
I've got to come back to most things.
Yeah.
And if I don't, I'll say I don't know. But the next time you see me, I definitely will know more to say about it.
So why didn't you want to become a manager?
Because it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous idea to work extra hours for less pay for more stress and more criticism. But, you know, if that's what you want to do going forward, then go wild, yeah. But
you said you want the best for certain teams. Like when you're talking about QPR, yeah. You're talking about the captain there.
Yeah.
You like the collective. You like the way football clubs work. You want things to be improved. You want to do unusual, maybe have a slightly like different angle on things.
Yeah.
You've got the intelligence.
Well, but what I'd say is like, so what? That's the thing. It's just not for me. Like, I want to make a difference, and I think I can still make a difference within football clubs, but not necessarily in that role. Like, the stress that, say, everyone goes through supports a team when they go and watch them on a weekend, that sense of helplessness. For 16 years, I didn't have that because I was playing. So then to all of a sudden, like, I've seen, like, managers come in on a Monday and have to say, this is the plan for the game on Saturday, and work at it every single day. And then I've seen on a Saturday, within 5 minutes, nobody's doing it anymore. But you've, as a manager, have invested time.
Yeah, but if you're a really good manager, you can use your charisma, you can use your...
So all really good managers are successful?
No, obviously.
So that's the point.
I know, but let's imagine you were going to be a really good manager.
Yeah.
Using your charisma and your ability to analyse things and hard work and blah, blah, blah.
Literally doesn't mean success, because you need the buy-in from the right players and not every club.
Yeah, but that's part of it.
Okay. So what you're saying is, you know, for the way that I think, put me in Man City and I'll be successful.
No,
do you reckon that'd be my first job?
I'm absolutely not saying that.
Okay,
I'm saying,
so where do you begin?
There's diligence. Yeah.
So where do you begin?
Well, it's clear that you aren't going to be a manager, because it takes a hell of a lot of like graft and all this other crap and dealing with dickheads. No. But it's clear
I'm sure everyone just heard that. Sorry, is this headphone not working?
It's clear.
Okay.
That if you wanted to graft towards something like that,
I could work
your way up through the leagues.
But
that is what it does.
Yeah, I love the fact that, say, I can be down here today. Someone will ask me, can I do something? I say yes or no. But when I say yes or no, it's not necessarily because I'm busy. It might be because I just don't want to do it. And I'd rather do nothing or have space to do whatever I want to do on that particular day.
Fine.
As a manager, it's not that. Like, you're in the way that football management works, the players basically assume that you live at the training ground, because they're always there when they arrive and always there when they leave. And they're just everywhere, you know what I mean? So I don't want to lose that time. I spent 16 years traveling around, and I got to a point where I loved days off to spend with my wife, with my kids and so on. So why would I then choose the one job within football, which takes even more time than what was there beforehand?
So based on all of this, looking back over it, do you feel a little bit more sympathy, for example, for Stuart Pearce and some of these other people who you felt were kind of dickheads?
No, because they made the choice.
Right.
And also for some of the things which they did, they didn't have to do, because it's not like page one of like the coach's manual. Some of the weird things are like, it's just personality based. Like, as a manager, in some ways, I've seen managers have good spells at clubs through just being a nice person, because the players that you have can play football. So if you give them an environment which they want to be in and something they want to be a part of, like, it might not last for a long time if they're not good enough, but little things make a difference. Like, you'll see with some teams, there are times when a team will be getting hit on the break and everyone's sprinting back, and other times where it's one or two people. Ask yourself, why would sometimes one or two people come back, but other times everyone would? Because when it's everyone's buying into each other, the setup, the club, and they win together, they lose together, they score together, they defend together.
Mm.
And you get that from having a manager who sets the tone whereby this is about togetherness, as opposed to somebody say, well, that's not my job. You know, as a football club, everything's your job.
So if we may change lanes very slightly here, you talk towards the end of the book in particular, and you've mentioned it a bit today as well, about the kind of the attitudes in dressing rooms not always being the most inclusive kind of places. Recently, we saw Jake Daniels become the first openly gay professional player in the UK. I'm really interested to get your view on this from inside the game, because obviously you've been very honest about what it's like just being a footballer and what that life is like. I've heard that within football, and I'm not asking you to name names or anything or speculate on anything here, but I've heard that within Premier League clubs, and just in football in general, it's known in certain dressing rooms that some players are gay and no one cares about it. And within football itself, that it's actually a lot more progressive than we've led to believe. We've been led to believe. So there.
You say you heard that from footballers.
I've heard it. I've heard it from people who've way down the grapevine, not directly from a player.
Yeah. So I can only talk about my experiences within this. But then also football, like, it's got a lot of people in it, but then everything's very close as well. If something happens, like, everyone knows it. Like, those WhatsApp groups and stuff. If there's a picture out of someone today, this morning, it's every player in the football pyramid seen it or whatever. So what I would say in regards to that is that with the places that I've been, there's nobody that's come out and openly said that they're gay. And football isn't that progressive. It might be a fraction more progressive than, say, overall society.
Mm.
But it's not that progressive, because I know people who, when in dressing rooms, like, they'll be saying sexist stuff, homophobic stuff, racist, they'll be saying racist things. And the reason it's okay within football in their minds, because it goes under the umbrella of banter. Like, the word banter, if I could have it removed, like, I think that'd be the best thing possible, because it covers up for a lot of nonsense. And, like, I know certain people who I've played with where if somebody came out and said they were gay, on the outside, they might say something to support them or say nothing, but on the inside, they'll start going in showers with them and they'll start acting differently because of them. That's what goes on. So it's easy to say how you'd be, but the reality of the situation is you've not had to address that yet within your space. And I think if you did, you would then find the reality of football kicks in, because, like, the people who play football are just regular members of society, but they just get paid more and do a different sort of job itself. So I wouldn't buy into that too much, but I hope that he is supported. But then I also hope that people don't try and treat him differently because he's come out and say that. Like, you should champion him for being able to have the strength to come out and say it. But now what's next? Can other people come forward? Or is it going to be a case now that, you know, before you know it, he's just sitting in the corner of the canteen by himself? And everyone says, oh, it's fine. Yeah, I'm glad that he's come out.
Mm.
But yeah, let me know when he's finished in the shower, if you know what I mean.
I guess that's why it's important then, is that it becomes gradually more normal over time. But that will take a hell of a lot of sacrifices from gay players in the game, which it doesn't seem
right. We've spoken about this a little bit on the show. Like, there's a lot of pressure to just conform within football. And being a homosexual is not conforming within football, because it's extra macho. You talk about, like, your sexual achievements and the women that you know and the people, oh, let's look on Instagram and see these Instagram models. I think I could DM her, this, that, all that nonsense, like, it's complete nonsense. But that's what comes with young, rich groups of men who have money and have power and standing. That's the way that they behave overall. Not to say everybody is like that, but at its core, that's what it is. So you can see why some people wouldn't feel comfortable coming out in that sense, because it is extra macho. But then as well, from the other side of that, like, the irony behind football is that sex is inferred, because we don't arrive at the training ground and just have sex just in the changing room and say, oh, this guy's straight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't see, there's nothing, there's lit, but right. but some people are very comfortable with us because they just assume that they're straight.
Right.
So then I wonder to myself sometimes, and this is like a much later point in the grand, in this journey of, you know, people of football being really inclusive. Like, if somebody came out, if three quarters of my squad that I was with at QPR or something came out and said that they were gay, but, oh, that's cool. Because again, like, someone's sex is inferred, but my relationship with them was never based on anything sexual anyway.
Yeah.
Like, this is my friend.
Yeah, nothing's different.
Yeah, literally, you can tell me that. It's like, oh, I'm happy that you feel comfortable to come out, but are we going to go and train now or what? Because we're like, we need to get out in the next minute, otherwise we'll get fined.
The reason it would matter would be if you constantly made homophobic jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe that comes back to normal in the dressing room.
That is more normal in the dressing room. And I think as well, within football, people know when things aren't right, but not everybody feels they've got the leverage to be able to come out and say it. Like, if your manager says something which you know is not right, who do you speak to? Because if you try and speak to him and say it's not right, if the manager's the wrong type, you're never going to play. And playing feels like it's the most important thing. And, like, I get it for some people, because playing means they live in the house that they live, they keep their families secure, and they can actually, like, try and plan for more than just, like, the next week, because they have a stable situation. And that sort of fear of instability is what I think essentially won't drive change, because most people fear sort of rocking the boat because they don't have enough power to be able to address things that need to be addressed.
Do you see the progress in the taking the knee and the power that Black Lives Matter movement has had as being in keeping with that? Because such a proportion of players are now able to talk about things and there are so many black players in the game.
They are.
Do you see it as almost being a part of the fact that, like, this is now the corporate thing that we do?
It is a bit corporate. It has become a bit corporate, but then I don't necessarily hate that fact because, you know, sometimes change needs to be driven by the big wigs, by the big spots, because otherwise the people below won't do anything of the sort. Mm. So I'm glad that they do it. I'm glad that it's being discussed. And, you know, there are certain companies who are doing more than that now. But the visibility is the first key stage. But the visibility at times is the easiest thing to do. But I think for some, but that's as an organization because it doesn't have a face to it. But for some of the players who have a face to what they're potentially trying to stand behind, they're always supporting until the point where they reach pushback. And then when they get pushed back, it's a case of, do you have enough empathy to continue pushing through? Because that's when it will be more black people that will continue to take a knee or to be saying that it's an issue, as opposed to some people who said, you know, maybe it's easier if we all stand together and put our arms around each other. Maybe it's easier if we just put something on the shirt. You know, the easy thing isn't necessarily going to be the thing that brings more change, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah.
Hitting you with some deep points here, aren't I? You never expected this, did you?
I did expect it.
Yeah, we did.
Actually,
no. I'm in the right place then. I didn't take a wrong turn.
That is exactly what we expected. Having read the book, yeah. Is there anything else you feel like you'd want to talk about before we break
So I'm not somebody who was obsessed about writing a book or telling their own story because I've kept it ridiculously private throughout my entire life. You know, even in the realm of social media, my account's private. And then to add even more irony to that, the people that follow me, they don't really get many pictures very often. So that's how private I am.
Just
like
check.
I actually live in the real world.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
Does Rebecca Vardy follow your account? Or?
Well, if she did, she wouldn't be getting much anyway. I think according to my Instagram feed, I only have 2 children, yet my son is turning 4 in the next month. So, you know, that's where I'm at. So the book itself, it serves a purpose and I'm very happy to be very open and honest about it. And there'll be people who won't like it, but don't click along for like a one line or a highlight because it'll get thrown out of context. Because one thing I believe I am is fair. And for all those people who maybe I didn't like within my career, I'll still tell you about how it affected my life in a positive and negative manner and the things which I learned from it. And I think that's key because it's not a book whereby I'm trying to air out all my grievances. It's a book where I'm telling my story about how I came to be who I am today. And I believe I'm a good person and I believe I was a good teammate. And as a consequence, like the stories which I tell, you know, they're being told for a reason. So I'm proud to have been published and proud to see my face like in bookstores and stuff. And also the people who will buy it, you know, I think they'll get it. I think they'll understand it. But some of the people who won't buy it, but then read one chapter about what I said about Harry Redknapp, I think you're missing the point completely.
But you might enjoy it.
You'll definitely enjoy it, but you're missing the point, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. In the sense that what was special about this life story from football was how honest you were able to be about not just about the people, but about the obstacles that you encountered and how they affected you. Some things that you, it wasn't a case of you saying, oh, look, I've managed to overcome everything and I've solved it and this is what I've achieved. It was about saying, yeah, some of these things I would have done it differently. I did hope it would go differently. And I think that's a real strength. And that meant for me anyway, that despite the fact that you're talking about a world that's completely inaccessible for almost the entire population, it felt accessible and relatable because of the way that you were talking about it.
I appreciate that.
Congratulations.
Mission accomplished, yeah.
Yeah, and thank you so much for coming in to join us.
No worries.
Really, really enjoyed chatting to you.
It was a pleasure. No, I just need to catch my train back up north.
All right, straight off,
yeah. Anything for the football ramble.
What a legend. Pick up, everybody, Nedim's book, Kicking Back, at your favourite bookshop. Or if you want to buy online, why not use hive.co.uk? Every order placed there supports local independent bookshops. Get in touch with us with what you'd like to read next. I'm on @KVLMason. Jim is.
I'm @JimCampbellTFR.
Or you can tweet us @FootballRamble. And we'll be back next month with another great book from the world of football.
Football Ramble Presents is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.